Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the at-large ad hoc working group on IANA transition and ICANN accountability call, taking place on Friday, the 21st of August, 2015 at 1300 UTC. On the English channel, we have Gordon Chillicott, Yasuchi Kitamura, Olivia Crippen-LeBlanc, Alan Greenberg, Cheryl Langdon-Orr, and Shoen Ojideji. On the Spanish channel, we have Alberto Soto. We have apologies from Heidi Ulrich. From staff, we have myself, Terry Agnew. Our Spanish interpreters today are Veronica and David. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking, not only for transcription purposes, but also for our Spanish interpreters. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Olivier.
Thank you very much, Terry. Olivia Capanablon speaking. Have we missed anyone in the roll call? No hands up, nobody shouting their name out, so the roll call is complete, and the agenda today, as it has been in the past few weeks, is to start with the CCWG accountability, working on the ALAC statement in response to the public comment period, and then we'll be looking, I think, both at the ICG, the IANA Coordination Group public comment period, and also the latest news from the CWG IANA. Is there any other business to add to this agenda, or are there any amendments that anybody would like to make to this agenda? Seeing no hands up, the agenda is adopted, and we can move to our agenda item number 2, the review of the action items from our last meeting. And since there were none, we can swiftly move on to item number 3. CCWG accountability with Alan Greenberg and Leon Sanchez, and I note that Leon has just arrived on the Adobe Connect. Welcome, Leon. And I gather that I can hand the floor over to Alan Greenberg for this, since he is, at the end of the day, the pen holder for the draft ALAC statement on the public comment period. Alan, you have the floor.
Thank you, and I'm actually going to cede the floor for a few minutes while I get organized and ask Leon, is there anything to report from the CCWG in terms of changes or issues that have come up over the last couple of weeks, I guess, since the report has been published? Because you haven't been on the last couple of calls. So is there anything that we need to be updated or alerted to before we start looking at the draft comment and how we're working on that? Did I surprise Leon so much that he's not prepared to talk?
We are dialing out to Leon as you were asking him, but he did put in chat no critical updates.
No critical updates. So he's turning it back to me, and I'm not ready yet. Okay, hold on.
Alan, it's Olivier. Leon did mention by email that he had to be let out of the jail by the judge before being able to speak. So
hello.
Be let out first.
Now
you've been let out. Good.
Sorry. No, there are no critical updates on the report. There will be some adjustments in the CWG bylaws matrix, but that's, it's related to the CCWG. It doesn't affect the report. So I think that the ALAC statement on the report may continue to be drafted and, of course, commented upon. So no critical updates or changes to the report. The only advancement at this point is that the public comment tool for public comment period 1 is being finalized. And, of course, it will be published pretty soon, so everyone can see how each of the comments that were made in the public comment period 1 were replied or addressed by the CCWG.
Thank you very much, Leon. And if I wait for three more seconds, I will now be ready to start.
Hand up. Olivier.
Yes, go ahead then, Olivier.
Thanks very much, Alan. Olivier Capanablanc speaking. And Leon, there was recently an announcement from the U.S. government that was going to renew the IANA contract for another year. Does that have any incidence on the Workstream 1 work timetable of the CCWG?
Thank you very much, Olivia. This is Leon Sanchez. No, it doesn't have any kind of impact on what we're doing. Actually, the announcement made by the NTIA comes after consultation with the chairs of the ICG, the CWG, and the CCWG, in which they asked us how much time did we need it to actually end implementation of Workstream 1 so the transition could take place. So we answered to Secretary Strickling with a timetable for our work, and afterwards they came up with the announcement of extending the contract for one more year. So since this extension is being made, taking into account the timetable that we gave them, there is no change to the work we're doing. We are keeping the same timetable, and we should be on track to end implementation of Workstream 1 by hopefully July next year. Or July next year is the timetable that we gave them. So no changes at all.
Do we still have Olivier?
I don't know. Maybe he got
you
cut.
You still have Olivier. It's Olivier speaking. You still have Olivier, but it's Adam who's in charge of this part.
No, Olivier asked that question. So I'm going to
very happy with the answer. Thank you.
I'm going to do a second part of the answer, even if you're happy with it, because many people have said since they have extended the contract for 1 year, that obviously means we have more time. These people are not really very good with arithmetic. Because remember, the implementation is not just for the CCWG, it's for the CWG. It's for all the other operational groups. We had said that if things go according to plan, the U.S. government will approve the transition sometime between March and June of next year. Once it is approved, we actually have to do it. Doing it is going to take a bit of time. How long it will take will depend on how much prep we've done and how much we've gotten done, but it's going to take a bit of time. The signing of the agreement to September gives us the period of time from whenever the transition is logically completed and the U.S. government agrees to the actual time to do the work is between March and September or June and September. June and September is not a really long period. So the extension of 1 year gave a little bit of wiggle room to make sure that we can actually get the work done without having to extend the contract past the period into the renewal period and then curtail it. So just to be really clear, it did not lengthen the time. It simply gave a realistic cushion to do the real implementation of the transition. And I think that's very important. In that line, and what we are going to look at first is the red line of the draft statement. And I believe, although someone may prove me wrong, that I have put in place effectively all of the changes that we decided on at the last meeting, and I'll go over them very quickly. We unfortunately don't have all the people on this call that were involved last time, and specifically not Sebastian, and a lot of them were driven by him, so that's unfortunate. Do we actually have apologies, or do we know what Sebastian's status is?
He did not send in apologies, and this is Terry. I can try to track down the phone number and see if we can get a hold of him.
Do we normally call out to him, or does he normally call in?
No, okay. He normally dials in.
Then let's assume he's occupied otherwise, and we'll have to deal with it. I'm sure he'll let us know if there's a problem. All right. So the first changes, if we look at the first page, the first half of the page are a couple of wording changes that were suggested. I don't think they're controversial. The term conceptual instead of philosophical, I'm not still 100% happy with it, but I'm happy to leave it there until someone comes up with a better one. In terms of the appeals mechanism, the question was, can the IRP set alternative mechanisms, or do they simply pass judgment? And so I tried to phrase that, and what I have now is the ALEC's understanding of the IRP is it's an evaluation of ICANN's actions and a determination of whether ICANN's bylaws and articles of incorporation were followed. The proposal text implies that the IRP will order a breach be remedied, but does not dictate what the exact remedy will be. The ALAC supports this and believes it must be explicit that the IRP cannot dictate specific courses of action. And I think that's in line with what we said the other day. And I've added one more thing that I had identified, and I wasn't sure if it should be in a comment or a question, but I think it's of sufficient import that it should be in the comment. And that is, there was a capability added to the IRP late in the game that it can reconcile differences between expert panel decisions. You know, for instance, the singular-plural problems we had with the GTLD process. And it says they can resolve them, but it's not one of the outcomes. So there needs to be, I think, a specific outcome that supports that kind of decision that the IRP may be faced with. Going on to page number two, there's something new, and the highlighted in yellow says that this is something that I've added that wasn't discussed before, so it's not a change in response to. And in reviewing later on, we had some changes on diversity. And in reviewing that, I looked at the section where it talks about diversity of the IRP panels, and it says, for instance, as an aspirational requirement that panels not have more than one person from the same region. And it strikes me that all other things being equal, that is a good target. But given any particular IRP subject, which may focus, for instance, on the laws of a certain region or may focus on needing certain skills which not all the panelists may have, do we want to put a provision in that skill set also has to be considered as opposed to diversity being something in its own right? And I see Sebastian's on the list, on the call now, and I guess I'll explicitly ask for comments on that from Sebastian and then open it up to anyone else. And I'm assuming Sebastian can speak.
Yes, Alan, thank you. Yeah. Sebastian Bachelet, I am sorry to be late and I have to...
You're here, that's what counts.
Back on the game. I know that it's your view and mine. You're right and I am right, I think, and that's difficult when you have three people to reconcile everything. I am not sure that we need to put the question of the skill. The skill will be within the seven, and how the choice will be made. Frankly, at the level of the three, I don't care. My view is that we need at the level of the sevens to have diversity. Okay. The three, we can't work on that because the choice will be made by one group and another group, and we can't tell them that no, you can't choose your champion because the champion chosen by the other group is already from whatever, already a woman, already a black people, already a European or whatever, then the three must not be a game for anything. It's the choice must be done by the people who are working on, and that's it, with no choice, no obligation for them except to choose between the seven or the 11 or whatever the number will be at the end. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Question, Sebastian. My recollection is that two of them are chosen by the sides, and the third is chosen by the other two. So they do still have some discretion on the third one. And I think we're agreeing. So you're suggesting that the diversity of the panelists really should be focusing on making sure there's diversity in the group of seven, or whatever the number is, and diversity should be considered, but not necessarily as the trump card when picking of the three. And if that's what I think you said, then we're in 100% agreement on that. Okay. Then I think I will propose some wording, and we'll look at it in the next call and see if you agree with what I actually propose in the wording. The next section on paragraph 319-334, we're just correcting wording. And I have worded a little bit about the 7 times 5 model to try to reflect what I believe is the position of the group. And what I now have is the ALAC would also support the 7 times 5 model should there be any overall support of this position. And in fact, it's the preferred solution for some people in the community, which I think does reflect what we discussed. And I'll go ahead unless someone says there's a real problem. The next parts are just typos in general, and goes all the way down to accountability, section 8 on accountability. On diversity. And what I've done now is taken what we discussed and tried to put it in the form of specific statements as opposed to the echoing what was in the report and my personal comments. And I'm going to leave, I don't think we need to go over them one by one, but I'll ask everyone to take a look at them, and particularly Sebastian, and make sure that that does reflect what we said. Well, I will summarize them. On Section 2, we strongly support the requirement for diversity, but I put in the part that ATRT may not be the right vehicle, but it certainly is one of the reasons that one of the places it could go. Sean, I'll go to you once I finish the quick summary. On Section 3, noting that there's a rationale included in the recommendation, subsection 4, that we strongly recommend looking at how to address diversity, and noting, as I said, that it could fit into the new group that was created out of recommendation 2, but doesn't necessarily have to. Sean. Shun says, I raised his hand, but we can read the comment. Can categorically be removed from 429 to 430. That's where we removed. Sure, I don't mind that. Anyone else feel it should be removed? Don't much care. Do we still have people on the call, or have I? Okay, Terry says finding the line.
You're still on, Alan. It's fine. It's just divine intervention responding to your question.
Okay, so we removed categorically. I sort of liked the definitive strength of it, but I'm happy to take it out. All right, any questions on the Section 8 on the diversity? Seeing no hands. All right. The next part we haven't actually reviewed yet, so this is new stuff. The first is the support of generally of Steve Crocker, who has brought this issue up again and again, that the wording in the Who Is AOC requirement, AOC section, is bad. And I support his position, I strongly support it, that we should not be putting words into our bylaws which we know are wrong. And specifically, as an example, the AOC Who Is requirement says that we need to do a review to make sure that Who Is information is universally available to everybody. We know that is against the law in many countries. To put a statement in our bylaws that is in direct contravention to laws in many countries without changing it to be a more nuanced thing, I think is just really wrong. We've made other changes to the AOC reviews because we have found errors in them, and I see no reason not to do the same here. So I think we need a strong statement. The other part of the AOC incorporation of the AOC commitments, reviews into the bylaws, was they recommended that the ATRT be the group that recommends that the other reviews be changed. And again, I find that just completely illogical to put the responsibility on one group to make recommendations about something they know nothing about, instead of giving it to the people who actually know what they're talking about. So, I feel pretty strongly on that we should be putting in a robust review requirement into the bylaws that will actually work and change over time, and not put in something that makes no sense whatsoever. The next part is the comments on the three minority statements. The one done by Eberhardt, I just do not think we can support it, although he makes a number of interesting points. The end recommendations I do not think are something that we want to support. Sebastian, I think we need to go over that in more detail, and I'm going to ask Sebastian to identify things that he really believes he wants the ALAC to explicitly support, obviously everything, but some of the things I think in his minority statement, he's simply putting on record that he was objecting to it, but without really believing it's going to change the outcome. And I guess I want a little bit of clarity from Sebastian. And lastly, the statement on by Edward Morris, who says that essentially AC should not have any have the same kind of voting right because some AC members are also parts of other groups, and he's specifically targeting the fact that some at-large members participate in other things. He explicitly identified Leon as being a member of the IPC. We know we have many people that are members of the NCSG. And his comment that perhaps we need to look at people who can vote in multiple groups, and that may have some merit. But other than that, I don't think his recommendation has any merit at all from my perspective. So we need to do a little bit more work on Sebastian's statement. Other than that, I think this is pretty much everything we've addressed to date, with the exception of two issues that were raised since the last extraction from the comments from the wiki. And I've put those on a separate document. Terry, if we could add put the document from the third bullet up, and those are issues raised by Avery and by Sebastian. Sebastian, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Alan Sebastian Machelet. Yeah, when you want, we can go through my minority report. But I wanted to underline that the question about the WIS review was not just Steve Crocker, Bush. I remember, but I didn't try to look when. But a few months ago, I say the same thing. As I was a board member at the time, we received the result of the review of the first review of the WIS review team, and we decided to launch the idea about the Directory Services Expert Working Group. I really feel strongly that we need to take into account what's happened since. One important point I want to raise here is that the 2009 affirmation of commitment was not didn't involve us or any part of the community. It was done by staff, maybe the board, I hope, and NTIAs. And I am not really concerned by the fact that it was written and that it's our law. It's not, and then the change suggested it's important that we take that into account. It's important because, as you say, we can't put in the bylaw something that it's not desirable, either feasible. And if it's not just at the WIS review and we think that there are other points in this affirmation of commitment we need to change, it's important to do it. And we will see if NTIA agree, and I guess affirmation of commitment will go away at the same time of the role of NTIA concerning the IANA function. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. If you had mentioned that, I forgot. I know Steve Crocker is the one who has regularly brought it up, generally supported by me, and Steve Del Bianco has, you know, shot it down each time. But this last go-around there on the email, on the mailing list, there have been a significant number of people who have supported him. So I think with our voice in front on the comments, we're likely to see that change. I think that will happen. I'm going to suggest that we go on with the overall program, and if we have time at the end, that we pull up Sebastian's statement and look at it at that point. But I don't want to run out of time this time. We're doing okay right now. We're only a half hour into the call, so I think we're doing okay. Leon, I noticed in the chat saying he was mentioned as one of the guilty ones, even though he's not a voting member of the IPC. And indeed, some people may not be voting members, some people may choose not to vote, or in some cases they may have a vote, but it's not clear that it makes a big difference in anything. So I think what I'm recommending we write is it's something that merits investigation. It's not something that we want to prohibit at this point. We certainly don't want to follow the minority statement advice. With that, I'm going to temporarily perhaps turn it back to Olivier for the next section. Oh, no, sorry. I'm sorry. We put a new document up, and when Sebastian started talking, I forgot about it. Olivier, we're not ready to talk about it yet. Is Avery on the call? I know she's not in Adobe Connect.
This is Terry. She's not on the call.
Okay. Just to, if you look at the first half of the page that was up in the pod, it's the third bullet. It's the document in the third bullet of the agenda. Avery raised an issue that she was concerned that although fundamental bylaws may only be changed by the board in conjunction with the members, that she believed the articles of incorporation could unilaterally be changed by the board. That is not the case. The articles of incorporation already have a provision in them saying if there are members, then the members must approve by a two-third majority a change to the articles of incorporation. Now, it's not quite perfect because, number one, it says that a two-thirds majority of the board may make this decision, whereas for the fundamental bylaws, it's 75%. It also says that the majority of that two-thirds majority of the members may change. Now, we only have one member. So the member either agrees or doesn't agree, but nowhere is it mentioned what threshold the member we will use to determine if the member agrees. And that one should be 75%. So there does need to be a change, but it's not nearly as onerous as what Avery has suggested is required. And I will put a recommendation into that and incorporate that into our statement. The next part is Sebastian's identifying, and I thank him because this passed me by completely. The changes to the bylaws on core values and things, in the original report they showed what the bylaws are now and what was being proposed. In this version, they showed the changes from the previous version and the new version, but not the original one. And I guess I'll ask Leon. I did ask for a document to be prepared, and Becky had volunteered to do it. Has that document shown up? The one comparing the original bylaws to the proposed new ones on the sections on things like core values.
I believe, this is Leon Sanchez, I believe that document is still a work in progress. I haven't seen a final version of that, but I believe that Becky is actually building that document.
Yeah, okay. Could I ask you to check on it, because it's becoming more and more crucial. This particular one, which I did not realize at all, because they've made changes in this last version, but not comparing it to the it wasn't clear how it was compared to the original. And when I look at it, I think it's quite important. And I'll be honest, I do not remember, but maybe Leon does, the discussion which resulted in it. Currently, it says where feasible and appropriate, depending on market mechanisms to promote and sustain a competitive environment. The proposed one essentially takes out where feasible and appropriate and simply says we must, adds the word, changes the wording slightly, but it essentially says there's no value judgments to be made. The competitive market will win in all cases. And my understanding is that is just that's just too wide ranging. If you remember when a number of years ago, VeriSign put wildcards into its searching, essentially said you would no longer get a domain not found, you'd get an advertising page. And ICANN shot that down on the basis of stability and security. But that's the kind of thing that the free market may well do things which are good for the free market, but not necessarily good for the overall environment. And I have great concerns, so I strongly support Sebastian's recommendation that we object to that change. Any other comments on it? Olivier has a tick mark. Leon has a tick mark. Leon, do you have any recollection of the discussion on that?
No, not really, Alan. I am not really sure how we came to drafting this core value, this new proposed core value, but I will surely find out.
Okay, thank you. All right, we have a number of tick marks, and I will incorporate both of those changes into the next draft of the document. And at that point, I now, again, turn it back to, we have some hands up. I don't know which order they came in, but let's go with Sebastian first and then Olivier.
Thank you very much, Alan. Sebastian. Yeah, just to tell you that you took this a comment I made, but I have made another one the same day but it was embedded in an answer to comments already done, and I would like to raise it again. Maybe it's to be put somewhere else, but it's written in the paragraph 346. I will cut this paste in the chat. It will be maybe easier. Wait a second. Here, I hope it's readable with you. The question of voting threshold with no vote, abstention and non-participation will all be treated the same way. I really think that whatever we want to do, we can't treat the same way people who decide not to abstain, the people who decide not to participate to a vote, and the people who don't say something, who no vote. No vote is to be against, against abstention and non-participation. It's not the same thing. And it's really a struggle I have with Kant on the board. And if you vote, if you abstain, it's like you vote no, and that's not the meaning of abstention. Then we need to figure out how we want to really to do it, but writing this like that hurts me. If you want to have some time to think about it, just to tell you that I had all those comments. Thank you.
Thank you. I do have a response, since I was one of the people who worked on that section. But first, Olivier. Olivier, is this on a different subject, I presume? So do you
Yes, Alan. I'm not going to respond in advance to a question or a point that Sebastian's made. So I gather you're going to respond,
respond. Yes, I will. I guess there are a number of points. I'm one of the people who raised the issue of abstention with exactly the same intent as what Sebastian is talking about. When we came to look at it, there is a conflict, not a conflict, but a tension between two things. If you discount abstentions, then you end up with decisions being made potentially by a relatively small part of the community. So, for instance, the ALAC explicitly says in its normal votes, we do not count abstentions. But if you have sufficient abstentions, you only have a small number of people voting, since we're only starting with 15 to begin with, not dissimilar from the 20 in the community mechanism. And you end up where a decision might be made by three people voting one way and two the other way. And that has a problem, too. So we did come up with an algorithm which says you don't count abstentions, but there must be a certain number of votes being actually cast. You can't have too many abstentions. And you must have a reasonable number of ACs and SOs participating in the process, because otherwise you can have decisions being made by a very small part of the ACs and SOs if fair amount of abstentions. It became a relatively complex process and didn't end up being very different when you looked at how the counting was done from what we are proposing. So the net result was very, very close, even though we did it. There is, however, a logic to what is being done right now. In a normal vote, it makes sense to have someone saying, I don't want to participate. I don't want to say anything, and I'll leave it to the others. If you look at, again, the ALAC mechanisms, most of our votes, we don't count abstentions. A few of them we do. One of the ones we count is for removing people. We can remove an ALAC member. We can, but to do that requires an absolute number of ALAC people supporting the activity. So in that one, abstentions count as no's, because we are looking for a two-thirds, I think is the number of people who are saying, yes, remove that member. And all of the community activities are of that form. That is, they are making a crucial decision and should only be made with a large support from the community. So there is, in fact, an argument why abstention should count as no's in this case. And even if you disagree with that, the two mechanisms ended up with very, very similar results regardless of that because of the need to have a large amount of involvement in making crucial decisions. So that's why it ended up being like that. Sebastian, you want a rebuttal, and then we'll go to Olivier?
Thank you, Alan, Sebastian. It's not a rebuttal, but I think what you explained, I get your point. It will be interesting to have it somewhere recorded in the report, because the sentence like it is, it's from my point of view not acceptable. When I heard your explanation, and know this explanation before, but it's a little bit different. But I really think that no participation, we need to have a threshold for participation and a threshold for the voting from my point of view, but at least we need to have somewhere an explanation, as you have done now in the report. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll note that. Olivier?
Thanks very much, Alan. Olivier Clapin-Blanc speaking. I just took a little time to unmute. Reverting back to the previous discussion we had regarding the changing of the text from where feasible and appropriate, depending on market mechanisms to promote and sustain a competitive environment, to a proposed depending on market mechanisms to promote and sustain a healthy competitive environment in the DNS market. I believe the source of this might have been an interpretation, a special interpretation, of the affirmation of commitments, section 9.3, which mentions the promotion of competition, consumer trust, and consumer choice. That looks specifically at the DNS as such. But there's one thing to note. In the paperwork that is currently signed, the DNS is taken by the U.S. government as being names, numbers, and protocols. But I do agree that the way that it's put there at the moment is not correct. You know, the promotion and sustaining a healthy competitive environment in the DNS market, the promotion bit is what I'm really concerned about. And I'm also concerned about the depending on market mechanisms, because that's nowhere, and that's not in the AOSC either.
Thank you, Olivier.
Maybe we have to point this out, because you will have people that will make the point and say, well, it's in the AOSC, so you have to be targeted on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivier. The market mechanism is already in the current bylaws, but it says when feasible and practical, or some words like that.
Yeah.
The first revision put in the healthy, the competitive market part, and the healthy and competitive market, whatever it is, and added it to the core value. The second revision today took out the whole phrase, incorporated the word healthy somewhere in the middle of it, and removed the if feasible or where feasible part of it. So the first revision did attempt to take that AOC part and move it into the core values. The second revision changed it, in my mind, quite completely.
And that's what we need to focus on and push back.
Noted. All right, then I think we are finished with this part, unless we have time at the end to come back to Sebastian's minority statement, and I'll turn it back over to you for the next major section of the agenda.
Thank you very much, Alan. So Olivier Crépin-Blanc speaking, and now we are entering agenda item number 4, the IANA Coordination Group section. I'm not sure whether we have the ability to have any update. I don't see Jean-Jacques nor Mohamed on the call, unless they're in the voice only. But what we do have in front of us is the current statement that we're trying to build in order to respond to the ICG public comment period. I'm not sure whether, because I know that Terry has been preparing the page. Let's have a look. If you scroll to the bottom of this page, are you able to see the comments? Because that's where the action actually takes place. The comments are empty, Terry.
Yeah, I'll get them up. One moment.
Okay, thanks. In the meantime, you do have the link on your agenda, and you can click on this. There's been a small, not very sustained discussion on the two different points. The first one is to do with the IANA.org and the intellectual property rights that had to be either remaining with ICANN or going to the IETF Trust or going to some kind of a third-party trust of some sort that would be created for this purpose. Since the feedback or the input that has been sent by the chair of the board to the working group, and that was discussed yesterday on an INSCWG call, it appears that everyone is pretty much okay with transferring it over to either a new trust or the IETF trust with some specific conditions related to it. So if we do decide at the end to comment on this, we'll probably have that comment reach after the train has left the station or after the ship has sailed, whichever analogy you want to say. I would therefore suggest that the ELAC does not now include a comment on this issue in its statement. That's the first of the 2 points that was discussed. The second of the 2 points that was discussed is the one that Tijani brought forward in a previous call about the assemblage, so the assembly of the three proposals that gives some kind of a three proposals that instead of having some harmonized proposal from those three proposals. And there were concerns that Tijani has expressed on this. I don't know if Tijani wants to say a couple of words on that. We're obviously going to have to make a decision at some point, because further down, Avery Doria has said that she is, of course, understanding of the fact that it would have been better to have an integrated proposal. She doesn't think that there is a threat to the stability as such, due to these three different proposals, and so she doesn't really think there's that much of a discrepancy between them as such. And so we have to think as to whether we really want to push in one direction or another direction or something that fits somewhere in between the two points of view. The floor is now open, and I see right now, let's have Tijani speak first, perhaps, and then Alan Greenberg. Tijani?
Yes, thank you, Olivier. Tijani speaking. I have put on the wiki my comments, and it is about the compilation against assemblage. I see it more an assembling effort than a compiling effort, and I think that it is in the duty of this ICG to make the three proposals fit in a single one. What I am seeing is a merging of three proposals, merging without, I see it like this, without the necessary harmonizing.
Right.
Because we have, for example, we have for the review, we have one entity called IFR for the names, and there is another committee for the names called, I don't know what is it. So I think that the review of the IANA should be one single structure. Inside it, the three operating communities should be represented, so that the decision of this entity will impact the PTI. If it is like now, each one is alone, It might be one of them wanting to separate PTI, for example. It will be a mess. If they are together, the three together, they will decide together. They will see what is the impact on the three functions, and they will take the right decision. If it is like this, I think it will be a mess, and we will have unexpected problems in the future. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tijani. It's Olivier speaking. And did you read Avery's response to your comment on the chat, on the commenting on the wiki? Because in there she does say, yes, there is a risk for the separation, but she doesn't think that it would be that strict. She thinks that theoretically it would be, or she hopes that if one of the organizing committees, constituencies, decides to get to the point of discussing removal, all three communities will start discussing this and see what they do, rather than actually having one just jump off in their own direction. Yes, she does agree that it's not good to have the three go in different directions, but she's not that concerned that it's going to go in two different directions.
Okay, it is exactly what I wanted to say. I wanted to say that it should be a common decision. So it should be a structure, a common structure that will decide. Like I am reading now, there is three different structures, and one of them can take any decision that may impact the PTI. That's why I see it more puzzle putting together than a compilation, than making the three communities come up with a single proposal which is harmonious, which is workable also. Thank you.
Thanks for this, Tijani. Let's move down the queue, and let's go for Alan Greenberg next.
Thank you very much. First, I think it's important to understand that today, the numbers community, to a lesser extent because of the tie-in to the N in ICANN, but certainly the IETF has the ability of pulling the plug and walking away. They came close to doing that a number of years ago when IANA was not doing a good job in satisfying them. So that problem exists today. We have managed to avoid it by working together. So I don't think we can ever fix that. Even if we had a harmonized committee, if the names and numbers people were happy, because everything was working perfectly for them, but the IETF couldn't, was totally unhappy, they would not accept the fact that, sorry, they're overruled by the committee, they're going to have to accept it. That the world is not going to work that way. The IETF survives by its protocols being used by the world, and that has to work. So if indeed they are so unhappy, being overruled by the other two is not going to count. So I think we have the reality of the world that we have to deal with. Now, in a better world, the ICG would have simply asked for the three communities to come up with a joint proposal. That never would have worked in the world we live in. However, if the names community had delivered their proposal by, I believe, mid-January, when we were supposed to, the ICG would have had many months to work on these proposals, to try to fit them together, to go back to the communities and say, can you work together? Can you meld these ideas? Can you come up with something that is more unified? We, the names committee, did not give them that option. We didn't deliver something till 6 months after they had asked for it based on the timeline they are working for. I think we have a result to bear. I think we have to live with the results of that. That being said, I believe in our comment to the ICG, I believe we do need to note the problem and say that we hope the operational communities will work together to come up with some joint way of sharing information and making decisions so that we don't have one of them cleaving off suddenly without any advance notice and without plenty of discussion on it. And I think we can do that. The CSC maybe will change over time because of that, and this is not necessarily cast in stone. So I think we need to note the problem and say we hope during the implementation and once we start getting into this that the three operational communities will find a way to work together so that we can cover ourselves for what we couldn't do because of time and other issues. Thank you.
Thanks very much for this, Alan. A response from Tijani.
thank you very much, Alan, for this explanation, and I appreciate what you said. Nevertheless, I want to remind you that now we have the stewardship of the NTIA over the three functions. So IATF cannot pull the plug because they are not free to do so. When we will get rid of this oversight, what will happen? This is different. But I agree with you that perhaps it's a problem of time, but I don't think that the ICG did the effort to try to find, because it was easy to propose to the three communities something that fit everything for the three proposals, but it is how to say harmonious, and that makes the decision, common decision, that will not make the mess happen if there is a problem. Thank you.
Thanks for this, Tijan. It's Olivier Clapin-Leblanc speaking, and I have a question for you. You look specifically at the time when there could be a separation and therefore a split in the functions. Are you seeing any other locations in the overall proposal where there are discrepancies which you think the ICG should be working on to harmonize things?
Yes, for sure, Olivier. Even for the PTI board, they receive input from the CSC, from the IFR. They receive input from the two other communities. But how they will be reacting if they have, for example, a strong statement from the naming committee, the naming community, and nothing, a full satisfaction from the others? How they will react? They will be in a bad situation. It is on all the day-to-day work of the PTI. I think that for stabilizing the PTI, it is better to have something harmonious, common, and with a decision-making shared between the three communities. Thank you.
Thanks, Tijani. I'll give the hand over to Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. I have no qualms with that, disagreement that it would be better. But we didn't have that opportunity, and we don't right now if we want this transition to go through. And I disagree with Tijani. The NTIA grants is currently granting to ICANN the right to run IANA. But it also has never objected to the fact that we have an agreement with the IETF saying the IETF can cancel. And if the IETF cancels, then we can still pretend to be running a protocol parameter registry, but that will not have the current up-to-date values, and these values change at a very high rate and are added to at a very high rate. They would not have the current values in them, and the world would immediately stop using that and start using whatever the IETF offered as its replacement registry. So I think we have the problem today. We have finessed it so we've never seen it, but that problem is there today, and from the point of view of the IETF, if they don't have a reliable registry, they will find one somewhere else. I mean, talk to Andrew Sullivan about it. And he's head of the IAB. They're not going to go into court for 6 months arguing about it. They will have a registry, and it will appear suddenly. And, you know, they have no choice but to have an operational registry that actually works. So I think the world is not all that different. And I think we have a strong incentive to work together, but I don't think the ICG is in a position to mandate it. If you go back to the CWG right now and say, reopen the CSC and reopen the IFR process so that we can merge with the other three groups, we're going to be here till kingdom comes. Thank you.
Thanks very much for this, Alan. It's Olivier Crépin-Leblanc speaking. And I personally also do have a concern about sending this back to the ICG and getting them to talk or to get this coordination, actively involved in the coordination, in that on the one hand, what they appear to have done so far is to just point out a few things and throw it to the operational communities for them to work out between themselves. I have had some difficulty to understand how the coordination takes place between the different operational communities, but I believe that takes place at chair level. that's probably how it works. Regarding drafting something, I see at the moment we do have a discrepancy in our, or sort of a disagreement within our ranks. The only proposed text that I might have would be as follows. In the event of an operational community reaching the decision to replace the ANA functions operator, they should discuss their decision with other operational communities prior to proceeding forward and seeking always to keep all of the INA functions undertaken by a single INA functions operator. I think that's probably the only thing I can at the moment see as something we all agree with together. I've put it on in the chat at the moment. Let's see if we have some responses or feedback on this. Tijani Benchema.
Thank you, Olivier. I don't disagree with you, but I would like to make it more general. You are focusing only on the separation event. I want it to be more general. It means that we notice that there is no common decision-making body among the three communities. It might be harmful for ICANN and for Internet, especially in the case of separation. That's why we think that, as Alan said, it is necessary to consider this point and the implementation phase and try to find a way to make the decision-making body a single one, which includes the three communities. I think it is more general, and it gives the opportunity to perhaps correct something during the implementation phase. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for this, Tijani. It's Olivier speaking. I'll try and see what I can draft out of this. I must say I'm also of the view, same view as Alan, thinking, well, knowing the history of the IETF with INA and some of the history behind it all, we're actually quite lucky that the other two operational communities are still there and have not just decided to go on and do their own thing. You know, that's the sort of background to what's been happening. So putting asking for anything which will push the three operational communities for closer integration in general looks to me like something that will generate some strong pushback from the other operational communities. We can put it down, but you know, at the end of the day, Tijani, what is your aim for this? Just to have the three operational communities closer together? Tijani?
My final aim is to make all the ICANN community know that the end users have remarked and have tried to highlight the fact that the spread of the decision making between the three communities may bring harm to the internet. That's all. I am not asking to not approve or to say no, you have to do that or you have to do that. We have to make our point because it is important for the internet. If it is possible,
okay,
it is better. If it is not possible, it is not possible. That's all.
Thanks, Tijani. We'll work on this after the call then. We'll sort of bounce off a few ideas to get the text right. Alan Greenberg, and probably Alan will be working with us on this.
Just to reiterate what you said, at this point, we cannot fix the formal proposal. There is no time, if we want to transition in this go-around, to go back to the communities, and it would be very painful going back. It's not something that would happen in 2 weeks. So all we can do is put in a fervent wish that once the mechanics are over, operationally, there is communication and dialogue. Whether it's formal or informal, we can't really dictate, but we can make that statement and make it a strong statement. Thank you.
Thanks for this. Tijani, your hand is still up.
Sorry.
Okay, thanks. Now, oh, Avery has just joined. Okay, she's joined, just missed the discussion on this. So what we've decided to go for is some text that will go in the line of what I've mentioned, or what I've put down on the chat, in the event of an operational community reaching the decision to replace the ANA functions operator. They should discuss their decision with other operational communities prior to proceeding forward and seeking always to keep all of the ANA functions undertaken by a single ANA functions operator. But what we will do is to amend this and consider the points of bringing operational communities closer at implementation phase, and that means enhanced communication, enhanced dialogue, etc. That probably is the moment when at implementation is the time when we could bring those closer together operationally. Right, let's move on in our agenda. That's one of the points that we had. The second point on CWG is the VeriSign ANA root zone transition proposal. And there's an analysis underneath that that's also connected to your agenda. Alan, did you want to speak on this?
Sure. Can we have up the analysis? Well, while we're waiting for it, there's been a lot of confusion and speculation over what this is. Certainly, if you read Milton's latest blog posting, there was a presumption, and a reasonable presumption, because it was not very clearly written, what is being presented in this proposal. This proposal is not the elimination of Ike, of the NTIA's involvement with VeriSign. This proposal is the implementation of the recommendation, or perhaps the implied recommendation of the CWG, that during the transition we make as few changes as possible, and specifically, we do not put new code in place the day of the transition. Good engineering practice says don't make simultaneous changes if you can possibly avoid it. And in the discussion between NTIA, VeriSign, and ICANN, and this is an operational discussion of how to actually do the change mechanically, there was a fear of making any changes that was overblown in my mind. The CWG proposal said that on the day of the transition, instead of the NTIA dialing into its web interface, connecting to its web interface and approving changes, that ICANN do that. IANA do that. Somebody do that. And that was rejected, as that would require a substantive change. Changing the code to remove the check for has NTIA approved the change was deemed to be too significant, that no one wanted to do. So they came up with what is a very elaborate plan, heavily overkill in my mind, to not have to make any operational changes, with one exception, in the process. And what if you look at the document, the current process, and this is just a summary of what happens today, is IANA gets change requests. They make sure that they're coming from someone who's authorized to make them. They make sure they're not a problem. They, you know, for instance, if a registry says this is my new DNS that you're going to use for my zone, they want to make sure it really is a DNS server and not a random IP address. There's a whole lot of changes, checks they do. They send the change request, once it's passed their scrutiny, they send the change request to VeriSign. VeriSign does a number of its own checks in parallel. They also send the request to NTIA. NTIA approves it and tells both NTIA, both VeriSign and ICANN that it's approved. And VeriSign twice a day packages up any changes it has, incorporates them into the root zone, signs it, and ships it out. The new proposal, and this this is almost incredible, is they have decided, they're recommending that they, number one, replicate the entire root zone management infrastructure, a shadow one, as it were, or a clone, that a group in ICANN authenticates. In other words, if someone in ICANN plays the role of the NTIA by, in parallel to what IANA does, authenticates that, in fact, this change is good and valid. A lot of this is automated. And approves the change in this clone root zone management system. So this parallel root zone management system also creates a signed root zone. And the two, the one officially created by VeriSign and the one created by this system, will be looked at. Are they the same? Do the two parallel processes result in the same root zone being published, or would have if we had published the clone one? The requirement is that for 30 consecutive days, for 90 days, 3 months, they match. If they don't, they have to figure out why they don't, fix the problem, and restart the timer. Once they match for 3 months, the parallel root RZA2 is deemed to be doing the same job as the NTIA does. On the transition, they take the root zone 2 authentication and plug it in to the production authorization port. So what has proven to have identical results for at least 3 months now is the production thing replacing NTIA. And at some point in the future, they will change the code and decommission the parallel root zone infrastructure. I think extreme overkill for, instead of making a small number of code changes, or just having someone log on and pretend they're the NTIA, but nevertheless, that is what has been recommended at this point. People being exceedingly overcautious. And that's all it is. It has nothing else to do with the cooperative agreement. If that's going to be phased out, that's a different issue, not dealt with here. I've done a lot of investigation and discussion with people, so I'm pretty confident that what I'm describing is, in fact, the intent of what was published. And that's it.
Thanks very much for this, Alan. Olivier Crépin-Ablanc speaking. I have a question for you on this process, the proposal here. How do the changes in RZA2 go into the official root zone? Because here it says RZA2 also creates a new DNS signed root zone twice daily. But then it says the official root zone from VeriSign and the RZA2 root zone are compared.
Right.
But how do you get RZA2 to become the official root zone?
It never does.
So then how do you get any changes? Because the changes are made in RZA2, but the changes are not made in the official root zone.
No, the current process continues as it is today, with NTIA getting on and authenticating or authorizing every change. And that is what goes to VeriSign, and VeriSign publishes the root zone. If the two root zones, the fake one and the real one, compare equal, we tick off the half day on the calendar. If for 3 months every one of them agrees, then we declare victory and said, we have created something parallel to the original one, which is capable of publishing an accurate root zone. It doesn't. But we just sigh a sigh of relief and say, we now have a mechanism. Okay? On the transition, you take the authorization part of RZA2 and connect it to the authorization port that the NTIA uses. and that's it. The NTIA no longer inputs anything into it, and this parallel authorization replacing, parallel authentication replacing the authorization that goes into the port in the current root zone management system, essentially the RZA2 is taking over from the NTIA, or part, the authorization part of RZA2 is taking over from it.
Thanks for this, Alan. Olivier Capanoblos speaking.
Not the most obvious mechanism one could have dreamt up, but it does say nothing changes other than the pointer to an IP connection.
Thanks, Alan. It's Olivier speaking. And so the question that I do have here is, wasn't there a design team in the CWGINA that worked specifically at this and at the authentication and authorization part of the procedure and said that none was required?
None.
I'm a little confused on this one.
Okay. When I first read this, my interpretation was DT something, the one Cheryl led, I don't remember the name anymore, D maybe, said we don't need authentication. We don't need authorization. That is, we can just go poof, and we no longer have NTIA authorizing it, and it's okay. My first read of this was that the NTIA, in its wisdom, has said we were wrong. We do need some parallel operation to replace what they were doing. But that's an incorrect reading of this. What this is saying is we need a parallel process over the transition period so that we don't have to make any coding changes. And that's what this is. This is a parallel, this essentially is the implementation of the one sentence in the CWG report which says, if you don't want to make any coding changes at the moment of the transition, the cutover, then you can have someone in IANA logging onto the web port that the NTIA currently uses and authorizing the changes. So we glibly say either make some coding changes or pretend you're the NTIA, masquerade as. Between NTIA, ICANN, and VeriSign, there was a decision that neither of those were acceptable because any of those would cause a perturbation that, yes, someone at ICANN could log on, but we don't know if they're going to do the exact same thing the NTIA would have done. And therefore, they came up with this elaborate scheme to verify over a three-month period that the results are identical.
Thanks for this, Alan.
It stretches the imagination a bit, but honestly, that's what's happened.
Sean Ojedeji asks in the chat, when you say on the transition, what transition do you refer to? The stewardship transition itself, the transfer of stewardship.
The day, the moment, the microsecond in time where the NTIA says we're toast, we are no longer involved in this process.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Not when they give up, not when they sign the agreement to do it, but when we actually, you know, when Washington can disappear off the face of the earth and the Internet keeps on running.
Thanks for this, Alan. Are there any questions or comments on this call? And maybe just a question to you then, Alan. Based on your analysis, is there anything that we need to point out or any points that we need to make regarding this?
Only that
either in the CWG or in one of our statements?
Only that we think these people got a little bit too anal. And I don't know if we need to say that. We may well want to say something to that extent. By the way, I've consulted extensively with David Conrad, who's one of the key people in this whole process. So I have a reasonable belief that what I'm saying is in fact reflecting fact and not my fiction.
Well, the four-letter word that you just mentioned, was it? Let's move over to Tijani Benchema. You have the floor, Tijani.
Thank you, Olivier. Tijani speaking. Alan, I don't know if you are speaking about the content of the blog of the NTIA about the zone management, the route zone management, and the contact between ICANN, NTIA, and Verisign about it, because it seems that it is different. I don't know.
No, that this is exactly. The blog points to a proposal, and the proposal is what I have translated into closer to layman's languages. Yes, as Milton points out, this was not bottom up. This was done by the people involved. This is very much an implementation issue. It is exactly following the intent of DTF. What DTF recommended. It's just doing it in a far more complex way than any of us imagined anyone would want to do. But a complex way which requires no changes at the moment of transition.
Thank you for this, Alan. I think that we've pretty much gone all around that proposal. It looks like it's working well.
Hello?
I note Sean Ojedeji has put his hand up. Let's close the queue after Sean. Sean, you have the floor.
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead. Yes, we can. Go ahead, please, Sean.
Good. This is Sean for the record. Thank you, Alan, for making effort to try to explain this proposal in layman manner approach. But it looks complicated to me. But I think one key thing that I want to pick from this is that this was developed with the technical team of ICANN, especially David. And so I think if ICANN at the technical at that technical level, they could actually agree with this, and they believe it's not going to impact upon the operation zone update the request, you know, have any impact on it, then I think technically I will be fine with that if they are actually as the operator are technically okay with this process, seemingly complicated process that has been proposed. However, my question is the role of NTIA in all this. I see that you're saying that in the transition, during the transition, and this was all because of the question I was asking before, you're saying this virtual, this dummy route would actually be in place before the transition. So, if I get it right, are you saying that during the testing phase, for instance, this dummy thing will just be there for maybe the next 6 months, when I can agree that when NTIA agrees that the proposal, the IC proposal can move on. So is it just an implementation migration period that this will be done, or it's what will be used post transition? That is, after the transition itself, this is the approach they're going to be taking. If this is the approach they're going to be taking after the transition itself, can you confirm that there is no NTIA involvement in this? Because if you look at this, it still seems like NTIA will be used, NTIA process or interface will be used to approve the thing. What I thought I heard before was that it was going to be a PTI that will be doing the approval. So, but I haven't read through the proposal in detail anyway. Could you further explain, Alan, if you have an understanding of it? Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. Two things. Number one, I think I've had a hard time understanding you because your voice is somewhat fuzzy by the time it gets to me anyway. I think the first question was you want certification, as it were, that ICANN is comfortable with this. This is a joint proposal from ICANN, from the technical people at ICANN, and VeriSign, that they believe this is doable, workable, and will meet the need. So you do have that satisfaction that ICANN is comfortable with this. This is not an NTIA proposal. This is an VeriSign ICANN proposal that was done at the request of the NTIA. And they may well have talked to them along the way. I don't know. But this is an ICANN VeriSign proposal. That is, the people who are currently operating the two halves of the root process are comfortable that this will work. So that's number one. Number two, this is a transition process. That is, overall, once the NTIA is out of the picture, at some point in a more comfortable time, the coding will be revised to not require authentication authorization, and at that point, there will be no need to connect to authorize or authenticate, and the whole RZA2 process gets shut down at this point. The whole exercise is to verify that one could create a root, a signed DNSSEC signed root zone, on the same time frame as VeriSign does it right now in conjunction with IANA, and with the exact same results. So the whole parallel operation demonstrates that we can create a root zone without NTIA getting involved. As soon as NTIA gets out of the picture, the part of the NTIA, that the part that used to be played by the NTIA, will be temporarily played by the clone system, feeding into VeriSign this time, not into the clone generation. And then once the coding is changed, that link will be taken out. So it is very much a transition process. And when I say transition this time, not the moment of transition, but the overall, you know, long-term thing, which will take months. And once the microsecond of transition happens, the NTIA is out of the loop and are no longer part of the process. I hope that addressed all the questions you had.
Thanks very much for this, Alan. And I do note that we now have reached the 9th minute mark. I've been told that the interpreters are ready to stay for another 10 minutes on the line. And so I was going to suggest that we now move to one last thing to discuss, and that's the matrix of the ICANN bylaws. That is in agenda item number 5 as well. And in there, on that matrix, and I don't know if, Terry, you can put this matrix up, on that matrix, now that's the matrix of the different changes, that the amendments that will need to be made to all of the ICANN bylaws. The CWG IANA went through that matrix yesterday, the table, and looked at whether there was agreement on what was being said on the call. The legal team took us through this, and one was particularly sticky from what I can recall, and that was the one on number 9, I believe it is, 9A, so the appeal mechanism, the famous IRP, Independent Review Panel. Now, unless I'm mistaken in this, I do know that Alan had some specific points to make, and this was pushed back by some members of the team there, specifically saying, well, there should be an appeals panel for IANA decisions made by IANA. And the point that Alan was saying was that, well, IANA does not make decisions. It's actually this, IANA needs to carry out the decisions that have been made by the different operational communities. Alan, do you want to sort of expand on this, or is there anything really that we should, anything else maybe here, but also any of the other sections that we might wish to discuss so as to provide a clearer point of view that we can all work on during the next call? Because I do believe that the CWG IANA will be looking at that table again. That issue was left open.
Okay, thank you.
Alan Greenberg.
I'll be honest, I haven't read over this document. So I haven't gone over it bit by bit. That whole discussion, and it was a very long discussion that we went back to several times, was driven by Alan McGillivray saying, quoting out of the CWG report, that we said somewhere that the IRP could be used to question IANA decisions. And IANA doesn't make a lot of decisions. Right now, they do make recommendations to the ICANN board on CCTLD redelegations. However, CCTLD redelegations are explicitly excluded from the review process. So that's out. Chuck raised the question of GTLD redelegations, but those are done completely within ICANN and therefore are either subject to arbitration or whatever as dictated by the contract or conceivably the IRP, but that's within ICANN, so it's not an IANA issue. And I repeatedly asked, now I recognize the CWG may have said something, but you know, we may have said something in error. That report is not necessarily 100% perfect. And so I was trying to get out what kind of decisions does IANA make that one might want to appeal. And the only answer that came out of it was IANA does make one important decision many times a day, and that's the decision whether to honor a request or not. Now, in general, the mechanics of the process are that if a specific TLD, GTLD or CCTLD, makes a request, number one, they can only make requests regarding their entries, and number two, IANA goes back and asks the CCTLD or GTLD, did you really mean this? Now, it is conceivable that someone makes a valid request, they verify that it's valid, and IANA, for whatever reason, says we are not going to implement it. That's a decision they make. However, it strikes me that an appeal process, which can take 6 months to 2 years, is about the worst possible way that one would want to fix that. And although there may need to be an appeal, I don't think it should be the IRP, and I think it should be something that the CSC or maybe an IFR invents if necessary to solve real operational problems. So I don't think we have a problem with regarding the IRP. And that was the point I was trying to make, and I will probably make it again in an email. But that was the whole issue, that we may have recommended something that doesn't make a lot of sense, in which case somehow we need to fix the problem without reopening the proposal. Thank you.
Thanks for this, Alan. It's Olivier Crépin-Leblanc speaking. My understanding of this, and I was fully supportive of your point of view during the call, but my understanding is any appeals as such would go through, any appeals for ICANN decisions, I guess, would go through the ICANN appeals mechanism, which is in creation, and others would go like that. And the IRP was just a review of any disagreements that were taking place between the IANA operator and a registry and so on. I wasn't quite sure that the IRP would be used to appeal to a decision made by IANA.
Well, Alan McGillivray was saying that we had committed to it. But
well, this is where there's a serious thing. So
yeah, my point was, if we did, we probably erred, and we need some. You know, for the very few decisions that IANA does make, that if we need to find an appeal, then we need to have an appeal mechanism to the PTI board or to the ICANN board or to something or other. That we is if we need to go above the operational people, and there already are processes in place where the CSC can do this, and we've already said, I believe, that an individual operator can do this, I believe that's sufficient. So I need to review the words again, and I'll contribute something on the list to it. But it's not the IRP we want, in my mind anyway.
Thank you very much for this, Alan, and I agree with you. One thing to note, Rudy Van Znik on the call did ask for a diagram of who does what and what is the overall flow chart of control. I think that we had asked for this a while ago, actually, with regards to the different escalations, et cetera, and hopefully that will come out soon. But it certainly seems to be pointing that it means different things to different people. And so we've got those structures, but at the moment we don't appear to have seen what the remit of those structures are, or at least there are some question marks with some of the remits in those structures. Any other points in there? Of course, the floor is open for everyone to comment on this. Is there anything else that we need to discuss on this paper? This is important. It's the bylaw changes. And if we get those wrong, and if Sidley has been shown to go a little further sometimes than they should go in the past, it's important that we have a look at those and point out anything that we think might have been misinterpreted or might be going not in the direction that we wanted it to go. Alan Greenberg, you put your hand up briefly again. I'm not sure. Yes, it is back up.
I was assuming you were getting any other business, but since I have the floor, I'll take it. Sebastian, I put a note in the chat saying, can we talk one-on-one in the next couple of days about your minority statement. So just, Sebastian, if you can get back to me and we'll find a time. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for this, Alan. Let's put this bylaws matrix to the side. You've got the link to it in the agenda. Please have a good read of it if you haven't already. I'm asking everyone. And if you do have any points you wish to make, let's follow up on email afterwards. And with this, one more thing in any other business is to think about next week's calls. I believe that the idea at the moment that we have two calls a week, whilst quite onerous on our time, works rather well. We're able to keep up with things. I would recommend that we have another two calls next week again. Is there any objection to this?
We're going to have a webinar on the same subject, and I hope one call at the beginning of the week will be sufficient. Let's schedule a second one, but I'm hoping we can cancel it.
Okay, thanks. So let's do the next two calls. It's Olivia speaking. Let's do the next two calls by Doodle. Terry, if you could please work out the times of the Doodle based on the webinar as well, so that we don't have a case of having a call just before the webinar or just after the webinar. I don't know the exact timings of this. The other thing is to, and I ask everyone on the call here, please, for at least one of the two webinars, be nice to our colleagues in the Antipodes and do a few calculations and try and see, because poor Cheryl is yet again in the middle of the night, and I don't envy this on a Saturday as well. I hope you have a good Saturday after this, Cheryl. Perhaps you can sleep in later on, or maybe not. Knowing you, you probably have a full day. So. Okay, let's call this call to a close. But before that, I'd like to thank our interpreters who have remained that essential 11 minutes longer. And it's been a very good call today. So I thank you all, and thanks to our staff and Terry for being able to run such an excellent call. So this is adjourned. Have a great weekend, everyone, and speak to you next week. And carry on the mailing lists. This call is adjourned.
Thanks
everyone. Bye-bye. Have a good
weekend.
Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.